You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
I am what I am. I am my own.
Hi. I'm Andrew Child, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 32, La Cage aux Folles, and with us today is the author of that chapter, Professor Robert W. Schneider. Professor Schneider holds academic appointments at Penn State University, New York Film Academy, and the University of Mount Union. He is the artistic director of the J2 Spotlight Musical Theater Company, original programming producer at Feinstein's 54 Below, as well as the host of the podcasts Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, Gay Card Revoked, and This Was a Thing. He is also the co-author of 50 Key Stage Musicals. Hey, Rob, how's it going today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am doing well, thank you. So, we're going to be talking about La Cage.
Yes, we are. Poster's right on my wall. I don't know if you can see it, but it's right there. Right there.
Oh, I see it. Wow. There you go. Yeah. So, we know you're a true diehard fan.
I am. I got a poster.
You got the poster and everything. You got it behind you in your little Zoom setup here. Beautiful.
Yes, thank you.
Wow. So
yes, I love the show. Yeah.
Talk to us. You got the poster on your wall. Why does it get a whole chapter in this book? What makes La Cage a key musical?
Besides that, it was the first musical I ever saw on Broadway.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's my personal journey with it. In terms of why we study it, it's the first musical that has a gay couple at the center of the story. Mm. We'd had gay characters every like once in a blue moon prior to this, but this is the first gay relationship on a Broadway stage.
Okay.
We'd had other productions of like off Broadway, like Boy Meets Boy, and you know, superfluous gay characters and things like, well, not superfluous, I shouldn't say that, but periphery characters in things like Applause and Lady in the Dark, but this is the first time we're seeing queerness as the major central focal point of a Broadway musical.
And so in the chapter, you talk obviously a lot about what it meant to fight to put this story on a Broadway stage, what it meant to keep this show running on a Broadway stage, also to have it try out in Boston. Do you want to just summarize for listeners who haven't gotten a chance to read through the book yet? What did that actually look like?
Sure. So La Cage aux Folles was based on a very popular French play by Jean Poirot that is, if you've seen The Birdcage, then you've seen La Cage aux Folles, which was a farce. It was a farce where it's literally you can't take it with you. It's anti-mame just with a gay couple, which is it's a classic trope, which is a conservative family meets a liberal family. That's the trope, right? But in this case, the liberal family is a gay family. It's two men who are raising a 20-year-old son. And the 20-year-old son has come home to say, hey, listen, I'm getting married. Oh, and by the way, the parents are incredibly conservative and are incredibly homophobic. And then hilarity ensues, which it did in the farce. In the farce, there's nothing sentimental about it. Mm-hmm. It's a big, silly, fun farce, the same way You Can't Take It With You or The Man Who Came to Dinner is. Got turned into a movie in the late 70s. And that foreign film, because it was an Italy-French co-production, was a huge international hit.
Which is crazy because when you watch it, it's like, But your mouths don't line up with what you're saying because no. that word co-production
yeah.
is super generous. It was like a Italian-French like clusterfuck, you know?
Yes,
like,
it was that from the original French version, Michel Serrault, who played the Alban character, he did it in French and he speaks French in the movie. And then Ugo Tognazzi, who's sort of like a Harrison, like our equivalent, like a Harrison Ford, like Liam Neeson type. He's Italian and he's speaking Italian, but they've dubbed him in French. It is a interesting experience. However, though, the movie was a huge international success. And it's one of the first times we're seeing queerness being put front and center. It's funny. There's a heart to the movie. There is a heart to the movie. And that's what inspired Jerry Herman to write. He wanted to write the score of it. He looked at it and he said, this is a musical. This is a musical. These characters should be singing. Problem is, he got to the rights too late, and producer Alan Carr, who gave us not only Grease is the Word, the movie, but will also give us the incredible 1989 Oscar ceremony. And if you've never seen that, people, take a look at it. Alan Carr was huge at that time, and he got the rights to the movie, and he told Jerry Herman, I'm sorry, I've already got another team on it. And the team was Mike Nichols, who was going to direct it at the time. Tommy Toon was going to choreograph. Maury Yeston was writing the score. And Jay Preston Allen was writing the book.
Wow.
These are big names. I mean, these
are huge. That's
heavy hitters.
Yeah.
And then over time, all of those original creative team just sort of went away. And nobody, you know, and it's like a, like I say in the chapter, it's like a Rashomon quality of why did they all leave? Some because of money, some because producers were like, we need gay, you know, we actually need people that are gay to be on the team. So Arthur Lawrence took over direction. Harvey Fierstein, fresh off a Torch Song trilogy, did the book. And Jerry Herman did the score. And all three gay men.
And I think you'll probably agree it makes a huge difference going from that movie to this musical that have these heartfelt ballads, these beautiful moments that just, if I talk about them, I'm going to get choked up and start crying. They're so stunning and beautiful. I don't think that a straight creative team, a totally heterosexual creative team, could have done this, at least not at that time.
No, definitely not at that time. But I think what's really important is, and it's the thing that calls Lacage into criticism today, is that Arthur Lawrence's main drive on this show was, he said, listen, yes, it's about gay people, but it's about family first and foremost. Mm-hmm. It always has to be about family and entertaining the audience. It just happens to be this family is, if there's a quote unquote problem with the family or what makes them eccentric, it's their sexuality. But at the end of the day, it's got to be entertaining. And because he went in with the idea of let's entertain the audience, he was able to educate them at the same time. I agree with you. I mean, I don't want to, I mean, I have lots of straight friends who are incredible allies, but I do agree with you. I think having straight people on creating a homosexual, a gay love story, I think, yes, I think some things would have been missed. I really do.
Well, and I think the proof of that, and I'll say that again, let's just say we're talking about contemporarily to this, you know? I think the proof of that is, you're right, the Lacage, the movie, that international sensation, there is some heart to that. Lacage 2 and Lacage 3 are just nonsense, like drivel. It's just like, haha. Man married that man and now they are fleeing because they're like in the witness protection program, you know?
It's
fun and I love it, but there's absolutely no heart, there's no backbone. I feel like that comes in with Harvey Fierstein, fresh off of Torch Song trilogy.
Yeah, and I think in the movie version, now this is also interesting, the when they got the rights to Lacage, they did not have the rights to the movie. They had the rights to the play.
Okay.
So things that were introduced in the movie, they could not use. So like the mother, the actual mother who shows up. They couldn't use her because she wasn't in the play. She was only in the movie.
Got it.
It's sort of like the Applause All About Eve thing, which was the musical Applause only had the story that All About Eve was based on. They didn't have the movie.
Okay.
So why was I'm just mentioning every single like gay totem for myself right now. And so, and then we'll go back. I'm sorry. You were saying, I'm so sorry.
Were talking about how we were talking about how this creative team was able to bring so much heart to this. And I think
yes. There's two moments in the movie that I find really fascinating that they can't put in the musical, and it makes me sad. Well, one they kind of do, one they don't. Mm. The one that's not in the musical at all is the beautiful scene where it's Alban has found out that he's not allowed to meet the family. And mm-hmm. so he goes to the train station by himself, and Renato comes and he sits down next to him, and he has this beautiful monologue about, I have the most gorgeous cemetery plot, and and it's so beautiful and it's so wonderful. And your cemetery plot, which is like 20 miles away, is a piece of shit, but I sold my really nice one because I just want to be with you for the rest of my life. It is mm-hmm. so beautiful. And if you're a fan of The Birdcage, it's the same scene where they're at the bus stop waiting. That to me, I was always like, why is that not in Le Cage? Why is that mm-hmm. not in the musical? I'm assuming because it's in the movie, they don't have the rights to do that.
Right.
But the thing I find really fascinating about the movie being adapted to a musical is the I Am What I Am song that Alban sings is actually, in my opinion, some lines that Renato has in the Le Cage movie. Because in the movie, he says to his son, he's like, yeah, I'm old. Yeah, I'm gay. Yeah, I wear makeup. But I know who I am. And it took me a long time to get this way, and I'm not changing. And I find it interesting. I understand why, but I find it interesting that they basically took the essence of that speech in the movie and gave it to the other character to sing. It makes sense. It makes sense. But I found that very interesting in the transition over.
And let's talk about that song. Let's talk about an iconic,
the national anthem of you know, as I understand it, it was written as a scene. Harvey Fierstein wrote the scene where Alban tells George off, and Jerry Herman said, one of the lines was, I am what I am. And Jerry Herman said, I have to have that. That's the song. And crafted one of the most beautiful theatrical moments in which this character who's been bullied and pushed around and thought less of for an entire act finally just stands up on their feet and says, if you don't like who I am, then you leave. I don't leave.
Right.
You change. I don't change. And I think for the gay community who had for so long in media been looked at as a punchline,
mm-hmm.
not sympathetically, as a laugh, to give that dignity, I think spoke volumes. Then to have it in the middle of the AIDS crisis, where not only are they jokes, now they're pariahs. Because remember, at that time, it was, oh God, there's a gay person. If they look at me, I'm going to get this. You know, a lot of theaters, I think in the West End, some of them laid plastic down on the seats because there was a fear from patrons that they would get AIDS by sitting on seats the gay people had sat in. Wow. And people didn't want to sit too close to the stage because there was a fear that the AIDS would come across the footlights and infect people in the audience. Mm-hmm. And we now we go, are you really serious?
Right.
It's absolutely serious. Absolutely serious. So to give our community an anthem at a time when we're getting bullied on both sides, it will never be underestimated what that song gave the community.
Mm. Even though in the original cast, it's of course being sung by a famously straight man.
That, you know, that was one of the, you know, I got a chance to talk to the original casting director of Le Cage, Stuart Howard.
Mm.
I said to him, you know, who else was up for these two roles of these gay men? And he named a bunch of people like Richard Kiley and John McMartin and, you know, Gene Barry, George Hearn, that ended up getting it. And I said, how come you didn't consider any gay actors to play the role. And he said, I'm going to be honest with you. He goes, can you tell me what openly gay actors were in 1983?
Right.
And he was absolutely correct. He said the one person that it came down to George Hearn, and it was Charles Pierce. And if our listeners don't know who Charles Pierce is, he was a very famous, he called himself a male actress. He was a female impersonator. And it was between him or George Hearn. Now, while he never did any like public stories about being out until much later in his life, that would have been close enough. But I think Stuart Howard is absolutely right, which is I don't know what openly gay. It's not like today, thank God. But right. by having a story like Lacage on stage, even though it's being played by two heterosexual actors, it's at least allowing the gay people to see, oh my gosh, my character at least is being represented on stage. And families that were maybe homophobic to go in to see it and go, oh, I see what's going on now. Mm-hmm. A personal story.
Yeah.
When we saw Lacage, I was 4 years old, maybe, when my parents took me to see it. And we went with my grandfather, who was a Marine, always had a cigar in his mouth, very tough. And this is a true story. He came to see the show. And after the opening number, where the guys took their wigs off and they revealed in the opening number that they were men, he mm-hmm. just got up and walked to the back of the theater. At the end of the show, unbeknownst to us, he had watched the entire show and was in the back of the audience crying, moved by what he eventually saw. And I remember afterwards, there was a shift in him. He never used the F word again. I never heard him speak about gay people in a pejorative manner after that.
Wow.
And yeah, so I think that's important. I think that's important. And I know, like I said, a lot of the criticism about Lacage now, the original production, is mm-hmm. it didn't do enough.
Okay.
And why were these two straight guys playing the gay guys? Mm. Well, one, you have to sell Broadway tickets. These guys sold tickets, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, I think it's important that the story at this time got out there, regardless of who was telling the story. I think it was important that the story got out there, which now allows us to have the conversation of now who gets to tell the story.
Right. And now, do you think, because I might go either way on this one, but do you feel like these are roles that moving forward should always be played by gay men?
I don't. I'm a gay man. I'm a proud gay man. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, my feeling is, what gets our story out there?
Mm.
What gets our story out there? Will and Grace, for my generation, I can only speak for my generation, did more, I think, to let people of my generation know that being gay wasn't weird, that being gay was normal. I don't give two shits that who Eric McCormick goes home and sleeps with.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that somebody saw a gay character and they said, it's not weird, it's not strange. And that's just my opinion, because I think when we go down that, it goes into a really slippery slope, because then I'm going to say, well, is this a two-way street? Does that mean gay people can't play straight characters?
Mm-hmm. Which was speaking of Will and Grace, the criticism.
Yeah.
Of Sean Hayes doing Promises that he wasn't passing, you know?
I mean, listen, first of all, I saw Promises. Trust me, that was not the problem with the show. He was lovely. I don't know. That was not the problem with that show. That's just my opinion. And I'm also older, so I think there's a whole new understanding that I need to... I understand where people are coming from. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that for me, it does not bother me. I was not bothered that James Corden was a straight man playing a gay man in The Prom. I was bothered by many other things. That was not
one
of them.
I was going to say, that wasn't the problem.
That
with
to me,
James
that was
Corden in The Prom. Oh, that was, yeah.
That to me, that hit, because I think at that point we just go down a slippery slope. And to me, Because to me, it's like an ultimatum. Well, the question is, if we can't have a gay person do this, do we just not tell the story at all?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm like, I think it's more important that the story is told. Would I love it that it was an all queer creative team and an all queer actors? And of course I would. Mm-hmm. Of course I would. But I also understand the situation, and I know the future generations will change that.
Mm-hmm.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Well, and then, you know, we're jumping ahead in time, but I can't imagine, I don't want to hear any criticism of The Birdcage, the movie. I can't imagine anyone doing those two roles. I can't imagine anyone doing any roles in that other than who was cast in it, but Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, you know, one of them being a gay man, is just so perfect.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And same, you know, same thing. It's like, I don't care that Robin Williams is a straight individual. I don't care. Mm-hmm. He's telling our story, and he's one of the biggest fucking movie stars, and people are going to go see the movie because he's a movie star.
And not only that, he happens to fall in that Venn diagram where, yeah, he's a big movie star. He's also a really great performer.
Absolutely.
He does that role. And that scene you were just talking about from the original movie is so beautiful with the two of them.
He and Mike Nichols also, I don't know how he identified, because I want to get into that. But okay. But Mike Nichols directs it beautifully. Directs it beautifully. So I think, going back to Lacage, I think that it's very important that the idea that the stories are being told, let's get the stories out there, and then we'll figure out later on who's going to tell it the next time. That's just my opinion, and I know there's lots of people who disagree, but I can only speak from my personal experience.
So, and this is a show that has come back to Broadway several times. It's gotten
every time it comes back, it wins Best Musical.
It does, yeah.
Best Revival. Best Revival.
It's got a great track record. Have you gotten to go back since you were four and seen it?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Oh, I saw the first night Robert Goulet was in.
Shut
for
up.
For the Jerry Zaks production, which unfortunately was not very good. And I love Jerry Zaks, but it was just not a good production. And I saw the first night that Robert Goulet was in it, and it was incredible because he had no idea what was going on. But then he opened his mouth to sing Song on the Sand.
Oh.
And you were like, I can die happy now.
See, I told you there's some songs in this that it's like, just say the title, I'm going to start crying. This is a great score. So sentimental. So beautiful.
That was really beautiful. And then I saw the one that Kelsey Grammer and Douglas Hodge did. That, to me, I think was the best production of Lacage I ever saw, because I'm going to be honest with you. It's not the most effective dramaturgically.
Mm-hmm.
The show, I don't think, but I think they were able to get a lot of nice things in that particular production. I've never understood. I'm like, why is the club so in the Broadway productions that I've seen before Douglas Hodge? No, who did it? Terry Johnson, I think, directed it. The club is always like some multi-million dollar extravaganza. And I was like, isn't it some like tiny little club?
Yeah.
And they got that brilliantly.
And I'm going to brag, because no offense to Douglas Hodges, but I saw that production on tour when Christopher Sieber was doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord. Incredible. Incredible. Love the production. But Christopher Sieber, brilliant.
Oh my God, yes. And they were the ones. There was a couple of things about the revival I really appreciated, which was, one, they said it's a seedy club, because that was the other thing I could never figure out, which I was like, if the father-in-law is the guy who wants to close down all these gay clubs, and Lacage is as big as it is, doesn't he know who owns it?
Right.
Like, wouldn't he know who owns this? That was always something that bothered me. And what I loved was that in the revival, it was this tiny little seedy, campy club.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually believed Douglas Hodge was a drag queen. Now, I love George Hearn.
Mm-hmm.
I love George Hearn more than anything, because I think he's so freaking talented. But he doesn't look like the star of a drag club in the Riviera. No, I heard a very good story, and I'm going to repeat it if I can. If it's too anecdotal, please stop me.
Okay.
They were doing a 10-year tour of Lacage, and it was going to be Gene Barry, who created the role originally, and Leroy Reams, who was coming in to play Alban, who was promised to do it before it closed, whatever. So when he sings Lacage, Leroy, he stops the number, and he worked this out with Jerry Herman, and he does various impersonations. He does like Mae West, and he did Carol Channing, and he did Tallulah Bankhead. And Jerry Herman was like, yeah, this is great. Now, he knew, Leroy, that Gene Barry and George Hearn didn't get along with each other. And so Leroy was like, I'm so nervous to show this to Gene Barry, because he's going to get angry. He's going to be like, George got all the great notices because it was the showy role. Now this guy's stealing my thunder by doing fucking impressions.
Right.
So he kept delaying and not doing it. And then finally at a run through, he had to do it. And Gene Barry's sitting there, and he does the number. He does Lacage au Folle with the impressions. And at the end, Gene Barry stands up and goes, that's it. He goes, that's it. He goes, with George, you'd never believed he was a drag queen. He goes, with George, he looked like a guy in a dress. He goes, he never once understood what drag was supposed to be. He goes, now this makes sense why this guy is so successful. And I love that, because it's actually true.
Right.
Which is, you know, God bless George Hearn. You look at him and you're like, you're the most famous drag queen on the Riviera?
Sweeney Todd, what are you doing here?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And listen, I saw it at Lincoln Center. I saw the archive at Lincoln Center. And George Hearn is fabulous in it.
I'm sure he is.
But that element that makes that's hard, which is, you know, it's that buildup. You've built up this character that he's a star at the Riviera. And that's all you hear about. So when he performs, you've got to believe, you've got to see it. And unfortunately with George Hearn, who really couldn't dance, he looks like a guy in a dress, and
And this brings us back to the conversation we were having before, you know, ethics aside, should these roles be played by gay men or should they not? Artistically, obviously, we gain something when the actor taking on this role is familiar with drag, is familiar with performing camp, is familiar with female impersonation, you know, is familiar with the culture. So it's like another level there.
Yes, Gary Beach had that. Leroy Reams had that. I don't know Douglas Hodge, so I can't say anything. But he had, Douglas Hodge had.
British, that's different, like training over there, you know, like that. We can't compete with that, you know.
He's been trained
since he was 12,
you know. And I also understand from a 1983 point of view why they might say, let's remind it that everyone that it's a guy in a dress, so that way it doesn't, you know, people don't go, boy, he's doing this all too, you know, that sort of homophobia. You know what I mean?
It makes sense, it all tracks. I just feel like we're coming back to, you know, we both said, yeah, we're okay with straight men playing this role. And now we're hitting on like a different facet of
straight
man playing this role.
If they can make me believe that they're the star of this drag show in the Riviera. Great. Great. But you have to make me believe it. You have to make me believe it. I don't care what you do in your personal, when you go home at night, but I got to believe this. I got to believe this.
So. Which I guess we do with Eric McCormick in Will and Grace.
It's a game. This might be a hot take. I believe Sean Hayes was in love with Kristen Chenoweth when I saw Promises, Promises.
Did you believe her back? Did you believe she was in love with Sean Hayes?
God bless her. Yes. She's so talented. That was one of those situations where like they were trying to beef up a role and it just threw the balance of the story off. Why are you beefing that role up? I don't know. And that's a whole other conversation.
We'll do that another episode. Yeah.
But yeah, so for me, that's why LaCosh is important. It's a long answer to a short question.
So where do we think, what's the future for LaCosh? Do we think it has legs to stand on to keep getting revived? Do we have performers we want to keep seeing in these roles? Or do we think it had its run its course? We had a grand old time. We'll see these songs in little reviews.
This is a really great question because I'll be honest with you. I think if they were going to announce this show tomorrow and it was actors that were not queer in the lead roles, I think that would be a big problem. I think that the community would not be appreciative of that.
And I think that it would be about the shows around it, that we've got some other things happening. Yeah. Some hot button things that it would be really hard to say, let's just look at LaCosh when we have these other tangibly bad casting choices happening across the Broadway season.
I also would love to see when it comes back. I would love to see when it comes back that the two leads, I mean, the whole show ideally, but the two leads are actors of color because we've never had that. It's always been white actors in those two leads.
Interesting.
And somebody had mentioned recently, they said, wouldn't you love to see Billy Porter and Brian Stokes Mitchell do it? And, you know, Brian is straight, but I would still be very happy. I think I think Billy Porter would be a fabulous choice. So, yeah, I think if the show can change with the times, that was another point that I thought was really, I have a lot of feelings about the show. I think that one of the issues that people have with the show is that, one, it's a little too, quote unquote, safe.
Okay.
You know, it's almost Dear Evan Hansen quality, which is the kid who's the asshole gets what he wants at the end. This kid comes in and says, Mom and Dad, I want you to go hide who you are. And they go, okay. Mm-hmm. And then he puts them all through all this crap. And at the end, he still gets the girl.
It does.
So like he doesn't get punished. I mean, he realizes he was acting like an asshole, but there's no sort of like.
But is that permissible here? Because like you said, you can't take it with you. This is the oldest story in the book.
Yeah,
it's like, we're not here to see someone get punished. We're here to see
it's a farce.
Conservative versus liberal versus progressive. Fight.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing that I thought the last revival did, which I was like, thank God somebody figured this out. Because I don't think I want to talk about Arthur Lawrence's direction.
Okay, that's fine.
There's a scene where they're at the cafe. This is before Song on the Sand. It's an outdoor cafe. And George touches Alban's hand. And Alban says, please don't worry. You know, we're in public. People are going to see us. And so you go, there must be people that are homophobic in this community. Everyone in this community welcomes them. Mm-hmm. And is like, George, Alban, how are you? And I'm like, what's the problem? Why is he saying there's homophobia? No one's treating them any differently. And in the revival, they was really smart without adding any lines of dialogue. There was a guy sitting upstage at the cafe who saw George put his hand on Alban. And you could tell the guy was like, the fuck is that? Mm-hmm. Why are two guys touching each other?
Mm-hmm.
And then Al Ben said, George, don't wear in public. And I was like, oh, there it now is. It makes yeah. sense. Mm-hmm. Now it makes sense that that because what they crafted originally was a community of like happy villagers where mm-hmm. everyone was like, we love you. And now, but now to bring in this idea of this guy being like, I don't know, why are the guys touching each other? Now it makes sense.
Okay.
So I would love to see maybe a little bit more of that in future productions. Mm. I think there's still a life to it. I mean, it's, you know, is it as progressive as other queer stories we've had since? No. But is it heartwarming and friend? And also, that isn't that part of like our queerness, which is to be like, we just want to be seen in a normal light the same way other characters are seen. It's a mm-hmm. family going through a problem.
Right.
It's a family, and all families go through problems, whether they're gay or straight. So to me, I'm like, I think it will last. I would be surprised, though, if the next revival did not, you know, feature actors of color as the leads, because I think that's what's going to have to bring it back.
Interesting. Well, and I also think, you know, I had, this was in Boston, and I won't say what theater it was, but reach out to me and a couple other people. They were like, we're having auditions for this play with, you know, cis gay male characters, and we really need to beef up cis gay men auditioning. And they were asking me to like distribute it and a couple other people I know to distribute to like the queer community. And I kind of wanted to just be like, what the hell? What do you mean? I can't throw a rock in a theater and hit like straight men. Like, what are you talking about? You can't find them. You can't. Now we have the opposite issue. Who, if we wanted to cast two straight actors in this, who would you go to? Where are they? Right?
Nowhere. I can't find them.
We drove them out. We don't have that issue anymore. So it is interesting.
Come back, guys. We're sorry.
Right. Right. When, you know, that's not a demographic that we're short on. So I think it's very possible to cast this with an all queer cast.
Oh, absolutely. Because now we have actors that are not afraid anymore mm-hmm. to hide their queerness. I mean, I found it so moving that the Boys in the Band revival featured all out actors.
That awesome. Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I think things like, and you can say what you want about, and because I know people have strong feelings, but people like Ryan Murphy that mm-hmm. are continuing to show queer stories and show them in specific lights. I think that's great. I mean, and I would be interested, honestly, to see a LaCage where it's two women as the leads.
And you know what? I was just going to say, if Ryan Murphy gets his little hands on this, you're going to have Kathy Bates and Patti LuPone doing LaCage. So.
Oh, fine with me. Fine me too. With me.
Me too.
I'll be there with bells on. But no, I think, yes, I think that because of the timelessness of the story, which is about family in crisis, that to me, I think will always, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are some shows that are more progressive, like I said, for queer stories that will not get done as much because I think at some point they're going to seem really dated. And LaCage, right. I don't think LaCage will come off as dated as some other pieces.
Well, because it wasn't, not only was it not aiming, like you said, to be progressive, it wasn't really even aiming to be cutting edge. You know, no. It was just aiming to have a good time, to be real, to and be sentimental.
And enough people liked it to make it win over Sunday in the Park with George.
Oh gosh. Let's talk about that.
It's what do you want to talk about?
I just think it was the correct decision, you know, let them have the Pulitzer, but you know.
I agree wholeheartedly. Act one of Sunday is lovely. And then you're like, what the hell's happening in act two?
Once laser starts going, you're like, yeah. Oh, I get it. They're going to win a Pulitzer. Okay. But I'm out.
Yes.
Get me back.
I know when we were putting the list together, people were like, I can't believe Sunday's not in here, but LaCage is. And I was like, can you tell me what Sunday opened the doors to except the exit?
Hey, that laser thing I'm is kidding. Cool. That laser thing is cool.
I think you can have both. I think you can have both. I think you can have, that's what theater is. It doesn't have to all be Sondheim. It doesn't have to all be Jerry Herman. You can absolutely have both. But I think it also is a pretty huge validation that LaCage, which is a gay musical, got the commercial Broadway seal of approval, regardless of our feelings at the Tony Awards, it still had enough people say, yes, this is, you got our approval.
Right.
And I think it would have had a much longer, I mean, and you know, I've talked to about this with some people on the original company, had AIDS not gotten as intense as it did, it probably would have had a much longer run. It was supposed to move theaters and keep going, but there was such a dip because of AIDS.
Okay.
People were like, you know, and people just, even though La Cage is one of the last gay musicals not to have AIDS or HIV as a part of it for such a long time, because right after that we got Falsettos, then Rent, you know, it was a steady stream of that. So this is that nice little pocket where there's gay liberation, but there's also no gay plague.
I wonder, because of that, when we study queer drama in an academic sense, you know, if we're progressing, you know, if we start with Oscar Wilde and we go up to, you know, whatever is the cutting edge, is the most progressive, do you think, and it's okay if not, is La Cage in that study? Is it in that curriculum, in that syllabus, or is it off to the side doing its own thing?
It depends, I think, on what you're trying to get across to the person you're teaching. If for me, I'll be honest with you, if somebody said you have to put a musical in here, I would probably pick Falsettos.
Okay.
Because I think Falsettos is stronger dramaturgically, and I think it not only it act one has, there's no AIDS, so it shows you what that little pocket was like of liberation. And then act two deals with the plague. And so I think, to me, that's a more effective story, because it's so intertwined with queerness. And like I said, La Cage, yes, they're gay men. It could literally be, like I said, you can't take it with you. Eccentric artists. You know, it's not, it's not the queerness could actually be swapped out for different things. And you would still have the same story. You can't do that with Falsettos. You can't say, well, they're not queer anymore.
Right. That's true.
You know, and we'll make them something else. You can't do that. It's like a house of cards. So I don't think La Cage is on that particular list of reading.
But certainly changes the trajectory of Harvey Fierstein's career.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, because first of all, Torch Song Trilogy is brilliant. But it
allowed, that's on that syllabus, you know, that's
absolutely in there. Absolutely. But it allowed, you know, and he was very young at the time, but it also it gave him a stamp of commercial approval, because Torch Song had gone, I think, from La Mama over a number of years. So to be brought in to be the book writer of a big, splashy, multi-million dollar Broadway musical, Jerry Herman, Arthur Lawrence, that gives him a huge stamp of commercial approval.
Which stamp of commercial approval feels like that's his business card now, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's so funny, because in that PBS, the American Musical series from years ago that Julie Andrews hosted, he's interviewed and he talks about La Cage, and he says, listen, La Cage isn't the first gay musical, but it's the first one that made money. And that's why it's important. And it's true.
That is true.
It's true. Yeah. But this, I mean, Torch Song, yes, gave him the seal of approval, but this is from the ground up commercial. It's not at La Mama. You know what I mean? It automatically puts him in a high level.
Talk about, you want a CD club? I bet they could have given you one. I bet they could have pulled it
Absolutely. I mean, that to me is like the La Cage that I like, where it's a seedier nightclub. It's a little campy. Because that's what that would have been, when it's like 90 guys like coming down trapezes and going down fire poles, which is what like the original had. You're like, huh? Like, how much dramaturgically, I just go, doesn't this guy, the father-in-law, doesn't he know? This is the biggest club on the Riviera. Like, how does he not know who runs it, who owns it?
Right.
And then he's surprised when he comes in. He's like, oh, I didn't know this was happening. I don't know. So I'd like to see what the next revival looks like.
Yeah. And do you have any further, like, is there anything you haven't seen yet in a production of Le Cage that you would be eager to see in a new revival?
They hinted at it in the last one. I'd like to see more of it. What is the threat? Okay. What is the threat? Why do these guys have to hide? What goes on in this? Because right now I can't tell. Right now it looks like everything's fine. And also what's really hard is you don't meet the antagonist until halfway through Act Two, which is you don't meet the father-in-law until halfway through Act Two. So like, how do you get that sense of what his homophobia is going to be like towards the beginning of the show? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Obviously in the movie they can
and in the movie if you remember when the guy picks on him at the bar,
he beats
him up, and we laugh because it's a funny it's a funny smash cut from him looking at the tall guy and then him laying with an ice pack, but at the end of the day he got beat up because he was gay,
right?
Like that's what's going on here. Like, do we? And maybe, maybe there was a feeling in the original production. I don't know. I never talked to Arthur Lawrence about it, but maybe there was a feeling in the original production that if they bring in too much of that, it's going to make it quote unquote political, or it's going to take the audience out of it. Right. So I don't know. Like I said, I know it gets criticism today, but I still think it's such a valuable step forward for the queer community.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Please, listeners, make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about Le Cage, please also review the links in the below description. I am Andrew Child, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast.
Say, hey world, I am what I am. I am what I am.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.